Valley Days, where Western history comes alive.
This is the Six Gun Justice Podcast with Wordslingers Paul Bishop and Richard Brosh.
Howdy, it's good to have you join us for another action-packed episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, where we celebrate the blazing six-gun action of the Western genre in books, movies, TV, and any other media at home on the range. I'm Richard Prosh, and next to me, searching for the next water hole, is my co-host, Paul Bishop. Howdy, pal, how are you? Thirsty. And why is that?
Because my canteen is already empty, and we've got a whole episode on Death Valley Westerns yet to trek across. But first, there are a couple of housekeeping items to address.
We always appreciate it when listeners check in, either by email or via comments on our various Facebook posts, with additional information on a subject we've covered, or comments on the content of an episode or speed listen. Six Gun Justice Deputy Tim DeForest reported in after our Trailblazer episodes with information about two Frontiersman comic book series we didn't cover, Ben Bowie and His Mountain Men, published by Dell in the 1950s. Tim claims Ben Bowie and His Mountain Men is one of the best comic books ever, with four of the six issues and all of the Ben Bowie solo titles available for free at Comic Book Plus.
Then there is regular listener George Cush, one of our Six Gun Justice Mounties up in Canada, who disagrees not only with us, but with most mainstream sources who refer to O.M. Wister as the pioneer of Western fiction. Cush claims the first Western novel is not The Virginian by Wister, but The Sky Pilot, A Tale of the Foothills, written by Canadian author Charles William Gordon, published in 1899 under the pseudonym Ralph Gordon. Apparently, The Sky Pilot, featuring Sergeant Steele of the Royal Mounted Police, was an immediate international bestseller and was eventually followed by more than 30 titles. Gordon went on to become one of the most successful novelists of the early 20th century, with a number of his stories becoming important silent films, including The Sky Pilot, directed by King Vidor, and Cameron of the Royal Mounted, both released in 1921. Cush told me President Theodore Roosevelt was one of Gordon's earliest fans and was so taken with The Sky Pilot, he invited the author to lunch at the White House before Wister made a similar appearance. Now, while I'm impressed with Cush's strongly held opinion that Charles Gordon pioneered Western fiction long before O.M. Wister wrote The Virginian, it seems to me The Sky Pilot and the other novels by Gordon are Northwesterns, as they take place in Canada and feature characters from the Royal Mounted Police. We did do an episode on Northwesterns because of their tangential connection to the Western, but in my opinion, they are not Westerns as we normally define the genre. While there's an argument for several other American authors writing Westerns prior to Wister, for my money, The Virginian, being set in Wyoming, with cows and cowboys, is still the true starting point of the Western and the themes that define the Western genre.
I have to agree, Paul. The Western, like jazz, was born in America. Anything else from our listeners we need to cover?
Nope, we are good to mosey on.
You're hitching up our Borax 20 Mule team. How about I fill in with a segment on Tom Horn?
Sounds good to me. Yeah, yeah, back off, you stubborn white dust-covered mule!
So recently, UFOs have been in the news a lot, but my one and only UFO experience happened on the road north of Laramie on Highway 30 outside Bosler, Wyoming. Bosler, Wyoming, of course, is the stomping grounds of Tom Horn. When Gina and I lived in Laramie, we used to take rides out into the range in the sports car that we had at the time. We didn't have a lot of money, so just driving around, seeing the sights was great. We would often do it at night because we both had studies to take care of and work to do. So this October night, about midnight, the weather wasn't all that good. I promise we hadn't had anything to drink other than strong coffee. We were driving out of Laramie, north, Highway 30, and all of a sudden there was a bright light right in front of me, right on the highway, like a big, round, circular light. I slammed on the brakes. Gina said, "What are you doing?" I said, "The light." She said, "That light is still a ways off." I said, "Yeah, but what is it?" It was mystifying. We sat there in the middle of the highway. Now, this is Wyoming. There's not that much traffic, so you can do that. We sat there, and the light moved, but it was hard to judge the distance. As we talked, we couldn't figure out how far away it was from us. I started to drive. I picked up speed, and again, it seemed like it was right in front of me. This time, Gina saw it and said, "Look, you better stop."
Richard and Gina Prosh, two average citizens out on a drive through the night in Wyoming, about to enter the Twilight Zone.
Exactly. That is exactly what it felt like. The distance on the thing was really deceptive, and finally, we figured out it was the light of an oncoming Union Pacific train.
You spoiled it for me. What a disappointment.
Yeah, the Union Pacific Railroad tracks ran parallel with Highway 30. We were only about 3 or 4 miles from Bosler, which at that time, there were a couple of businesses there, but they were the kind that were open when open and closed when closed, and you weren't quite sure what sort of business they were. We just stopped and watched the train, and eventually it caught up to us, and we watched it go by. But it was interesting. I was so enamored with the way distance and geography interacted with the road that night that I had to drive back the next afternoon and see it all in the daylight. What I discovered there in Bosler were a few old abandoned buildings and a derelict antique store where the old shopkeeper inside sold me a couple lithograph ink printing blocks that I still have. I asked him about Tom Horn because I knew that Tom Horn had been around the area 100 years prior. And he said the best book on the subject was by a man named Dean Krakel, a South Dakota fella. So immediately from Bosler, I drove back to Laramie and visited Laramie's favorite bookstore at the time, a great place with the unlikely name Books A Go Go.
Dancing girls in cages around the literary section?
Books A Go Go had free popcorn at that time. You could go in and they had a lounge where you could sit and eat popcorn, drink coffee, and read books. So here I picked up The Saga of Tom Horn, The Story of a Cattleman's War by Dean Krakel, which I still have. It's a fascinating book. It starts out with Krakel's vision of who and what Tom Horn was and his summary of Tom's life. But it also includes, in fact, the majority of the book is newspaper accounts and official documents and testimonies from the court trial. And Krakel believes Horn was guilty of killing Willie Nickel, the young man he was convicted of killing, and he presents compelling evidence from U.S. Marshal Joe LaFour's interview with Tom, an interview that was highly edited and skewed to make Tom appear innocent in the movie Tom Horn starring Steve McQueen. What do you think of the Steve McQueen movie, Paul?
It was Steve McQueen's last star turn. I can't say it was really a fitting end to his career from my point of view as a diehard Steve McQueen fan. But on the other hand, it was an outro Steve McQueen's well-documented difficulties earned.
I agree. The film is really problematic. It's beautifully filmed in Wyoming. In fact, when we lived in Wyoming, which was in the late 80s, the filming of Tom Horn was recent enough that there were still a lot of people at the university there who recalled when Tom Horn was filming in town. And there were stories all around Laramie at that time about Steve McQueen and various, he ate at this restaurant or that sort of thing. That was a lot of fun and why I really wanted to pick up the Krakel book. I think the film is ultimately really depressing. It's a film about civilization crowding out those who kept their independence with their guns but didn't have any other skills to offer. And regardless of the movie version where Tom Horn seems to be innocent of killing Willie Nickel, it's clear that he probably killed several other people that maybe he shouldn't have.
So it's a case of maybe you didn't do it this time, but you've done it all those other times, so we're going to get you for this time.
Maybe.
Warner Brothers insisted Steve McQueen make Tom Horn as the last entry on his 3-movie contract with the studio. And when you put McQueen in a corner like that, he's going to make it a rough ride for everybody involved.
Yeah, I understand there was another Tom Horn film to star Robert Redford that was undergoing planning at that same time, making Warner Brothers even more anxious to get the McQueen film shot.
The bigger problem came when Robert Redford dropped out of United Artists' Tom Horn vehicle, and CBS stepped in with Mr. Horn, a disastrous 4-hour miniseries about Tom Horn's early days starring David Carradine. The poor ratings for the TV miniseries really put the kibosh on any chances Steve McQueen's Tom Horn might have had.
There was also the problem of numerous script rewrites ordered by McQueen and his fights with 4 different directors, including Don Siegel, who all eventually deserted the production.
My belief is McQueen purposely chased them off because he wanted to direct the film himself. However, Directors Guild of America's rules forbid actors from taking over direction once a movie has begun filming. TV movie director William Wired was brought in to finish the film, but in reality he was simply a figurehead covering for McQueen, who is rumored to have done most of the directing.
The final product does have some good points, and McQueen is stoic as ever, despite being a little overweight and, in hindsight, looking somewhat unhealthy. As we know, it was shortly after filming Tom Horn that he was diagnosed with cancer.
On a brighter Tom Horn note, I got around to reading The Hunting of Tom Horn, the novella or novelette or short story. I get all confused about how to apply those terms. Is there a specific word range for each one of those?
Focus, partner, focus.
Okay, just call it the title tale from a short story anthology by Will Henry. I talked about a couple of the other stories from the collection last episode, but this take on Tom Horn is quite possibly the best of the bunch. The story starts when an Arizona Stock Association detective saves a young man from being lynched for brand blotting with a running iron. The stock detective is taking the amiable young man back to town for trial when the young man turns the tables on the detective and escapes. The young man, of course, turns out to be the notorious Tom Horn, but the story doesn't end there. The detective is the dogged sort who ain't going to let his quarry get away and begins to hunt Tom Horn into the deadly Apache territory where he's fled. The tale does justice to the two faces of Tom Horn, a man with no qualms about taking a life, yet capable of incredible acts of courage to save others when the mood took him.
It seems to me in today's jargon, Tom Horn would probably be labeled a sociopath.
Maybe back then he would have been labeled a sociopath if the term was in use, but today he'd probably be referred to as misunderstood or misguided.
Cynical much? Before we get ourselves into trouble, why don't we let loose the cattle and get on with today's feature? I didn't even know we were planning on doing an episode on Death Valley Westerns until I received a postcard from you about a month or so ago with a poster from the film Death Valley Rangers on the front and a note from you on the back saying you were actually in Death Valley and we should do an episode on the movies and TV shows that were shot there.
Yeah, there's a small town about halfway to Death Valley as you enter the national park that at Stovepipe Wells. We stopped there because there's nowhere else to stop. And inside, the first thing I saw were the postcards with the Death Valley Rangers poster on the front of them. So I was all excited. But we had just spent a number of days up in Yosemite National Park and had driven from there all the way to Death Valley, which is so desolate. There was a period where we drove for a half hour to 45 minutes and didn't see another car. It was pretty amazing. In the heart of Death Valley, there's this five-star resort called the Oasis, which is where we stayed. And we took day drives out from there. And after a little while, I really began to like the desert. The colors were amazing. There's this one drive called the Artist's Palette. It feels like the Cars ride at Disneyland, if you've ever seen that. It just winds through this desert landscape with these high towering mounds of sand. And it was just amazing. There was quite a number of films and TV shows that took place in Death Valley or were filmed in Death Valley. And I thought, why not? Let's do an episode on them.
It's a great idea. Our old friend, the late Ron Shear, who wrote How the West Was Written, lived in the desert, and I don't think it was Death Valley per se, but he did live in the desert. I never could understand that. How do you live in the desert? He and his wife had a house there, and he loved it.
I was very dubious going there. My wife wanted to go, but I didn't really have any draw towards it. But at this point, I'd definitely go back. It was that cool.
If not build a house, then live there, right?
No, we're not going to go that far. Let's not get carried away here.
We like our water too much.
Yes, we do.
So I looked up Death Valley Rangers, which was filmed in 1943. It's a tale about a succession of stagecoach robberies that prompt the citizens of a Death Valley outpost to send for the Trailblazers, a trio of law enforcement plainsmen in the personas of stars Ken Maynard, Hoot Gibson, and Bob Steele. Poster for the film, which you sent me on a postcard, is actually pretty cool, and it's a decent film. When the Trailblazers arrive in town to begin their investigation of the robberies, they learn from the marshal that Jim Kirk, the town's most respected citizen, is operating a profitable new gold mine. They also learn none of the stolen gold being transported by the robbed stagecoaches has ever been recovered. Bob Steele spies an escaped convict and makes him introduce him as an outlaw, so that he can join the gang and learn who the leader is. Complications ensue, as they do, when his first assignment is to kill Maynard and Gibson. It's a solid B-Western and worth a $4 rental from Amazon Prime.
Death Valley Rangers is only the tip of the overheated iceberg of movies and TV episodes filmed in Death Valley. Paramount's 1923 film Wanderer of the Wasteland, directed by Irvin Willett, was the first major Hollywood movie to be filmed in Death Valley. Based on the Zane Grey novel of the same name, which isn't surprising since Zane Grey was a name when it came to Westerns at the time, it was also Hollywood's first all-color film. Starring Jack Holt and Nora Beery, the plot involves two brothers, Adam, an honest cowpoke, and Gerard, a degenerate gambler. When an argument ensues over gambling addiction, guns are drawn and Gerard is accidentally shot. Believing he's killed his own brother, a distraught Adam flees into the desert. Adam eventually learns that his brother was merely wounded and returns to the loving arms of the beautiful Ruth, played by the director's wife, Billy Dove. The film is now considered to be a lost classic. An original Technicolor print survived into the 1960s in the hands of the film's director, who reported in 1971 that the 35mm nitrate film had decomposed. After Willett's death, his daughter stated the day her father discovered the film had decomposed, he went upstairs to his bedroom, closed the door, and cried for 3 hours. As I mentioned, his then-wife Billy Dove starred in the picture, and Willett had never really come to terms with their separation after he was lured away from him by none other than Howard Hughes.
Wow, there's some real-life drama there.
Yeah, it sounds like a soap opera like Dallas, only in Death Valley.
The writer of Death Valley, 1932, a.k.a. Destry of Death Valley, from Universal Pictures, was directed by Albert S. Rogel and written by Jack Cunningham, two men with an incredible array of early Westerns and adventure films between them. The movie stars Tom Mix and Lois Wilson.
20 Mule Team was filmed in Death Valley in 1940 and released with the tagline, "It's got the kick of 20 mules." In this one, the Death Valley setting is more than simply a dry desert backdrop. Instead, it's a rousing adventure about the industry of the valley and the borax miners. Now, that's rousing adventure, I guess. All about borax. A great cast rounds out the movie with Wallace Beery alongside his nephew Nora Beery Jr., Marjorie Rambeau, and Ann Baxter. Originally, the film was released in sepia tone, a brown and white process used the year before for the Kansas scenes in The Wizard of Oz.
A fun cast of great B-movie stars also graces 1941's Riders of Death Valley. Notice the plural. A Universal movie serial in 15 chapters starring Dick Forum, Buck Jones, and Lon Chaney Jr. This one was billed as Universal's all-star, high-budget Western cliffhanger. And it was, because interestingly enough, it provided a lot of stock footage for later serials.
B-movie star Rocky Lane and his horse Blackjack show up in 1949's Death Valley Gunfighter, a film directed by R.G. Springsteen, who directed scores of Westerns in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, including Cole Younger Gunfighter, Bullet for a Bad Man, Apache Uprising, and others. On TV, he worked on Bonanza, Laredo, Daniel Boone, and Gentle Ben.
Paul, you mentioned 20 Mule Team was filmed in sepia tone, and it wasn't the only Death Valley-centric movie to play around with the color. In 1953, Escape from Fort Bravo, an American Civil War movie starring William Holden, Eleanor Parker, and John Forsythe. Telling the story of an escape from a Union prison camp, the film was shot in Ansco color, a brand name that later became a favorite of Walt Disney's. The muted tones do a great job of rendering the sun-baked rocks of the desert, but not as well as another 1953 movie filmed in Death Valley called War Paint.
In War Paint, which starred Robert Stack and Joan Taylor, the producers used a stencil-based tinting process on film stock shot in black and white. I enjoyed seeing the sun-washed tones of the landscape contrast with the rich hues of Robert Stack and Joan Taylor's wardrobe. It's a primitive system that benefits the final cut, and unlike some other films, this one used its Death Valley location to spectacular effect. War Paint was directed by Leslie Salander, a man we've talked about before on the show for his direction of the 1956 Lone Ranger theatrical release. His catalog of films runs even longer than R.G. Springsteen's, starting with 1936's Empty Saddles, all the way through 1968's Arizona Bushwhackers.
I think that's a lost art. We do see some special effects with CGI in the movies today, but in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the way they played with color was really interesting. And I think in these films we've talked about today, you can see how they used the sepia tone or the tinted black and white film to convey the dryness and duskiness of the environment. It's a creative way to do things and a lot of fun to learn about.
You say we see a little CGI in movies today, casually. We see nothing but CGI in movies today.
You're right.
And the fact is, back in the day, these guys were kitchen sink type CGI.
It was homemade. Earlier, we talked about Steve McQueen with Tom Horn, that maybe he may have influenced some directors to leave the film because secretly he wanted to direct it himself. With One-Eyed Jax, we see Marlon Brando doing something like that.
Isn't it the only film Brando directed?
It is. One-Eyed Jax from 1961 is a Technicolor film directed by its star, Marlon Brando, and it is the only film he directed. Originally set to be directed by Stanley Kubrick from a screenplay by Sam Peckinpah, numerous studio disputes finally put Brando in the chair, and not all that successfully, even though One-Eyed Jax was eventually selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. Like so many movies that Brando touched, there's a tumultuous history to its creation. Setting out as an adaptation of the 1956 novel The Authentic Death of Henry Jones by Charles Nider, which was a fictional treatment of the Billy the Kid story, the screenplay was first tackled by none other than Rod Serling, then Sam Peckinpah, then Calder Willingham, the man behind 1970's Little Big Man, and finally Guy Trosper, who did the rewrites.
It sounds like one too many cooks in the stew. All of these big, great names, and it just doesn't mesh together.
You're right. When asked who really wrote the story for the final film, co-star and good guy Carl Malden is reported to have said, "There is only one answer to your question. Marlon Brando, a genius in our time." I wonder how much Brando paid him to say that. I love Malden in this film, as I do in just about anything in which he's featured. I think he's a fun actor to watch. However, I despise Brando. I find most of his performances borderline laughable in some ways. So there's that.
Okay. Prejudice much? All right.
What do you think of Brando?
I'm pretty much on the same side of the fence as you. Godfather is, I think, his most brilliant appearance.
Agreed.
But other than that, Stella. No, I could have been a contender. It just doesn't work for me.
He's just a little bit. He's a little bit too serious.
Yes, like James Dean on steroids. There's also been a number of other movies filmed in Death Valley, including The Three Godfathers starring John Wayne, The Law and Jake Wade with Richard Widmark, The Walking Hills, which is a reference to the drifting sand dunes, and starring none other than Randolph Scott. And many others.
Including one of your favorites, Paul, The Professionals.
What a great film. And now that I've experienced Death Valley firsthand, I'm looking forward to watching it again. Now, let's switch and talk a bit about Death Valley on the small screen.
Branded ran on NBC TV for 48 episodes over two seasons from 1965 to 1967. Chuck Connors starred as Jason McCord, an Army cavalry captain, court-martialed and drummed out of the service after being unjustly branded a coward. Though many scenes were filmed in Death Valley and Kanab Canyon, Utah, the action was assumed to be taking place in southern Wyoming. The pilot episode, The Vindicator, sees McCord confronted by newspaper reporter Claude Akins, who wants to write a story on the Bitter Creek Massacre. It was during this military action that McCord was wounded and left for dead. To his horror, he woke up as the only survivor. Charged with desertion, convicted in a court-martial, he was cashiered out of the Army. In Connor's previous series, The Rifleman, he carried a trick Winchester. In this show, Connor's character, McCord, carries the handle of his broken saber with the attached pommel. The blade has been sharpened into a long knife, which figures prominently in future episodes. Watching this opening episode of Branded reminded me of two episodes of The Rifleman, wherein Lucas McCain is subject to Death Valley-style heat. The first is Season 2's eighth episode, Ordeal, wherein a series of bad luck plagues Lucas and Mark as they return home from a salt-finding mission, resulting in Mark making a grueling desert crossing to find help for his sun-scorched paw. The second is the 17th episode of Season 3, Long Trek, in which Lucas and Marshal Micah Torrance escort a prisoner across the barren wastes outside Santa Fe. These entries weren't filmed in Death Valley, but they're absolutely part of that desert crossing subgenre.
Which brings us to TV's first and longest-running Western anthology, Death Valley Days.
Each episode was supposedly based on a true story from Western history, and the producers made an attempt to keep to the facts while still being entertaining.
I bet some of those episodes were more based on a true story than others. I always think it's humorous today when you go to the movies and there's this line that comes across the screen stating, based on a true story, or inspired by a true story. There are a lot of facts lost along the way between based on and inspired by, but neither one is going to let the facts get in the way of a good story.
This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
Absolutely.
Like many early television series, Death Valley Days began as a radio program created by Ruth Woodman in 1930. Unlike those other series, the Death Valley Days radio program was canceled in 1945, long before its television debut. The creation of the television series in 1952 is credited to Dorothy McCann and Mitchell J. Hamelberg of the McCann Erickson Advertising Agency, which was then representing Gene Autry's Flying A Productions.
The debut episode, How Death Valley Got Its Name, follows a group of pioneers who break off from a wagon train en route to the California Gold Rush, hoping to shave off time and distance, thereby beating the other settlers to the best claims. They try to do this by crossing the unforgiving Death Valley. This is clearly madness driven by greed and ends badly for most everyone involved. Filmed on location in Death Valley, the episode does a good job of showing the harsh realities of survival, which forces life-or-death decisions, such as when food and water become scarce while their destination seems further and further away. It's a harrowing introduction to the series and a fine example of the type of stories to come.
In actuality, only a handful of episodes took place in Death Valley, but the series took its name from the location because it was the source of the product manufactured by the Pacific Coast, wait for it, Borax Company, which sponsored the show using it as a platform to advertise its cleaning product, 20 Mule Team Borax.
And I still remember my parents having a can of that under the sink. Good stuff. The early episodes tried to present the illusion of reality and attacked on epilogue in which veteran character actor Stanley Andrews, who was billed as the Old Ranger, presented some kind of historical relic or artifact to prove the veracity of the story viewers had just seen. The coolest illustration of this artifice occurred in the epilogue from a 1960 episode titled A Wedding Dress. After the episode ended, the Old Ranger introduced the still very much living 80-year-old widow of the episode's protagonist, Marshal Bill Tillman. Zoe Tillman had published a biography about her late husband in 1949 and confirmed his upstanding character as it had been depicted in the episode.
Famous figures were often the subject of Death Valley Days episodes, including such dynamic personalities as Lewis and Clark, Kit Carson, Wild Bill Hickok, Calamity Jane, Billy the Kid, Doc Holliday, Judge Roy Bean, Lily Langtree, the Dalton Brothers, and Isadora Duncan. However, more often the series focused on ordinary people settling the West and some of the common problems and conflicts they faced.
Redemption stories were also regularly featured in which the protagonist of the episode had gone astray or started out on the wrong side of the law, and then eventually sees the error of their ways. There are also a number of episodes with stories centered around Native Americans, Black, Asian, and Mexican characters, which was a bold move at the time.
Stanley Andrews' Old Ranger character was with the show from 1952 until 1964. A who's who of much bigger stars then stepped in as hosts, including Robert Taylor, Dale Robertson, John Payne, and in his final acting work before running for governor of California, Ronald Reagan. Both Taylor and Reagan sometimes starred in episodes they hosted, which gave the series a twofer of the biggest names in Hollywood. The show was syndicated to stations across the country, which were free to air it whenever and how often they deemed suitable. Running from 1952 until 1970, the show started out being shot in black and white, but filmed a few episodes in color for its 12th season in 1963, and eventually going to full color in 1964 for season 13.
And to bring this episode back full circle to Tom Horn, in 1959, Greg Palmer played Horn in the Death Valley Days episode Perilous Cargo. In the episode, Tom Horn and his gang hijack a stagecoach full of future brides headed to Laramie. True to Tom Horn's perverse nature, he bonds with Della, the dance hall owner accompanying the other females, and in the interest of chivalry, he agrees to help them get safely to their destination, which means outwitting several groups of less well-intentioned villains.
Nice circle back, partner. Based on a true story, no doubt.
No doubt.
Well done.
There's the clanging of the chuck wagon triangle, Rich, telling us to wrap this episode up with our shootouts and shoutouts.
Thanks to Mike Bray and Wolfpack Publishing for being our premier sponsor. Thanks also to author Chris Enns, the Western Writers of America, and Roundup Magazine.
If you would like to provide a small donation to help with expenses and keep us moseying along, you can use the donate button at the top of our webpage sidebar at sixgunjustice.com. Donations are appreciated, but clearly not expected or necessary. We're grateful for all of our listeners and truly happy to have you share this trail ride with us.
Next Monday, Paul will be hosting a Six Gun Justice Speed Listen featuring everything you need to know about one of those wild women of the West, Annie Oakley, all in under 30 minutes, give or take.
And in 2 weeks, we'll be back with episode 37 of the Six Gun Justice podcast featuring the son of Morningstar's own self, General George Armstrong Custer.
And don't forget our Six Gun Justice conversation segments every Wednesday when we get to hang around the Six Gun Justice Corral talking with writers and friends who love the Western genre as much as we do.
Until we meet again, be kind to each other, be kind to yourself, and don't get on the bad side of Tom Horn.
Adios for now.
We're out of here. Let's ride.